as an example of the nation breaking down. Dean Ball on AI policy and the future of the United States. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, woman goes into a casino, plays blackjack, loses a ton of money, and then sues the casino. Which, of course, raises a question.
What? Why is she not liable? It seems like if you go to a casino, that's like, you know what you're doing.
Because at the time of those losses, she has...
Stories about blackjack this week.
This American Life, tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, while many Republicans are unhappy about Donald Trump's war in Iran, Senator Rand Paul was the only Republican senator to vote in favor of limiting the president's power to wage that war. And Trump, well, he calls Paul a sick wacko. I'll talk with Senator Rand Paul about Donald Trump and the state of the GOP next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. Last week, my guest, Gene Koga, and I spoke about perseverance. And I said then that this week, the theme would continue with my guest, Doug Ray of Narrowsburg, New York. Doug has been a widely recognized and very highly regarded leader of global media and marketing agencies. But that's just part of his story. And I am so excited to share how Doug has persevered through various challenges he's had in his life, and I'm going to jump right in and let the story begin. Doug, welcome to Catskill Character. I'm so happy to have you with me today.
Hi, Donna. What a pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
Let's start off with your childhood. You were born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. I don't really know that much about Dayton, Ohio, but I do know that it's a sanctuary city and it's the birthplace of the Wright brothers. What was your experience growing up there?
It was idyllic childhood. Lived in the suburbs, you know, of a relatively nice neighborhood. We were probably the most modest house in the area, but yeah, we played outside, ran around, and in general had a good childhood. I think, interestingly, had a lot more latitude. I remember being able to ride our bike, you know, 10 miles away to go to the swimming pool. And that was totally fine for us to be able to do that, my sister and I back then. But it was a childhood that I look back on fondly.
What you're telling us is there were no helicopter moms back then.
Yeah, certainly not mine. Mine was one of the very few mothers that was working from the time we were children. So I had a working mom, which is pretty progressive in the 70s.
Absolutely. She was a nurse. And your dad worked in the auto industry. You told me that he taught you the value of hard work.
Yeah, working in the automotive industry in the 1970s was certainly challenging. He, you know, lost his job a number of times working for a U.S. automotive company. And he always got back on his feet. He found that next job. And my mom stepped in and helped cover the bills while he was looking for a job. And I think cumulatively, that just taught me that if you get knocked down, you get right back up again and continue to support one another. And that perseverance is certainly something that stuck with me for many years.
You apparently learned that lesson well. And one of the places where you applied it was in sports. This is where we get the first glimpse of your intention to persevere. Let's talk about your middle and high school years competing in springboard and platform diving. You started at age 11, and at first you didn't get a lot of encouragement.
Yeah, I was on a neighborhood swim team. The diving coach came up to me and said, hey, we need boys in the 11, 12-year-old range. Would you want to dive? And I thought, oh, yeah, let's give it a shot. And I did pretty well at it. So I thought, well, let's continue that. My parents were encouraging, but as they started to reach out to different coaches and organizations that provided year-round opportunities for coaching, the replies were, he's too old for anyone that's going to go on and be successful in a career, a diving career, swimming career, but diving in particular, you know, they need to really start at age 5 or 6 years old. So I thought, well, gosh, who are they to tell me what I can and can't do? And I took that as a personal challenge to work really hard and show them you know, that I could be successful in my diving career.
Some people might take it the exact opposite way and just give up, but you persevered, you took it as a challenge, and within 6 years, you became the Western Ohio League diving champion, and you went on to compete at the NCAA level. But you started your diving coming from a place of feeling, let's say, less than. Do you think this can lead to a need to overachieve?
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, one of the things that I've learned as I've aged is that there were a number of contributing factors to overcoming those challenges. One of those was where I grew up. And as I said, we lived in a very nice neighborhood, but we were certainly not the biggest house, the nicest house, did not drive the nicest cars, yet many of my friends did. And I think now looking back on that subconsciously, perhaps there was this sense of, well, how do I achieve that? And maybe feeling a little less than because we didn't have that or we couldn't go on the same vacations that friends were going on. And that continued in diving as well. If people are telling you, you can't do something, you know, that for me and my personality, it sort of made me double down and prove that I could. So I think there's definitely been different moments in my life where I feel like there have been things that I had to overcome in order to continue to achieve the things that I wanted to achieve.
And I'm assuming that as you got older and you recognized that you were indeed a gay man, I was wondering if that also would contribute to your need to overachieve.
Yeah, I think that was a fundamental contributing factor. And I've spoken to so many of my friends who have also felt this way, which is growing up in the Midwest in a mid-sized town in a pretty conservative area of the country. In the 70s and the 80s, it wasn't accepted. In the 80s, we had the AIDS epidemic that was running rampant. And, you know, you didn't want to be associated with any of that. And so everything felt very negative as it related to my sexuality. And if anyone knew, I felt like it would put a ceiling on what I could or couldn't achieve. So that made me feel like, well, I had to work harder. I had to perform better in order to overcome for what I was perceiving myself as a barrier. And I think a lot of that was self-imposed as I learned, you know, when I did come out, a number of those things that I thought were going to be issues or were issues were in fact not. But again, a lot of that was self-imposed and things that I had to deal with over a 10 to 15 year period.
So when you moved to New York City, what about the opportunities for advancement? Were they actually there? Were they not there? And did you feel they weren't there because you had your own feelings about being gay and what that might mean in the business world?
Well, certainly one of the reasons I wanted to move to New York City was because I felt like it was a land of opportunity for many reasons, you know, not just because it was the epicenter of advertising and marketing, but also because it was so inclusive. And I felt like I could be more likely to be myself, you know, in New York City, as so many people do. Yet upon arriving in New York City and getting my first job, which was not easy, definitely had to use as many networking opportunities that I had, as many connections as I had. But when I did get that first job, the last thing I wanted to do was to come out of the closet. And so for 8 years professionally, I didn't tell anybody. And I did that because I didn't have the role models to say that you could be gay and be a CEO of a company. I just didn't see that. I didn't see that growing up. And so for me, it wasn't until I started to see in culture, whether it was MTV's The Real World or whether Will and Grace in the 1990s or the Ellen DeGeneres show, where I started to see more people that were successful coming out. And that made me feel like maybe a lot of this predetermined glass ceiling or this ceiling that I thought is there was just something I was projecting as opposed to it actually being there.
You know, Doug, what you're talking about is so important, but I don't want to forget that the listener doesn't know about your mountain accident. So that happened in 1990. Let's talk about that real quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was working for, this was a college sort of in between my, my sophomore and my junior year of college. And I got recruited for a publishing company that I don't know if is still around, but they started off as a a Bible, a door-to-door Bible company. And by the time I was working for them, they were selling educational books. And we were deployed in Colorado. And I was 20 years old. I was living out there in a family's house that had offered it up. And long story short, we were on a mountain on a Saturday as part of our sales team. And we were hiking. And I was wearing a t-shirt, shorts, and sneakers. And we were on a glacier front outside of Denver, Colorado. Needless to say, shouldn't have been there. And the glacier front sort of avalanched, if you will, not, you know, don't think of a big avalanche, but it started to give away. And I tumbled about 500 feet down the side of this mountain.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. When I landed at the bottom, you could hear people on the other side of the lake because it was a glacier that kind of ended in a lake. And so I landed down by the lake and I heard people gasp and say, oh, my God, he's dead. And of course, I wasn't. But that was a real moment.
Yeah, I'll say that. That was a real moment. But you persevered and you recovered. And when you did graduate from college, your career really moved at a fast pace. By the late 1990s, you were immersed in the digital transformation of your industry. You eventually landed at Kara, a Dentsu company, which and it's a huge global media and marketing agency. And you became the U.S. CEO and the global president at the same time.
Yeah, it was, I remember having a conversation with our head of HR. This is before I became the president and CEO of the agency. And she said to me, you know, where do you see yourself in the next couple of years? Or where do you see yourself going in the company? And without a beat, I said, the president, I said, I want my boss's job. And I sort of surprised myself by saying that. And I never in a million years thought that within 6 months I would have that job, which I did. And so it was a little bit of, oh my gosh, be careful what you wish for because your wishes may come true. But we were very successful over this first couple of years in that role. And the company came knocking again and said, we would like for you to do what you're doing in the US, but we'd like for you to lead the company on a global basis, but we don't have a backfill for you in the US. So you still have to keep running the US business, but can you also help us on the global scale, which I didn't have a lot of experience saying no in my professional career at that time and tended to say yes as a means of continuing to grow and just being flattered for the recognition. And so I took on both of those roles in 2013.
Yeah, I guess that's an indicator right there, isn't it, Doug, that you were very, very driven. And, you know, one of the things that was very impressive to me was not just about that aspect of what was going on in your life, but the fact that you were a board member of Bidawi, which is one of the country's oldest no-kill pet shelters. And that speaks volumes. What can you tell the listener about Bidawi?
So Bidawi, as you said, is one of the oldest no-kill pet shelters. It's been around for over 100 years. The founder of Bidawi was actually a woman. She founded the shelter on 38th Street and the FDR, or the East River. The reason she put the shelter there is because back in the 1700s or early 1800s, when this was founded, when people had farm animals, particularly horses that had become lame and they were done, they would drown them in the East River. She started Bidawi, which means stay a while. It's Scottish. And she would rescue the horses. And that's how Bidawi started. And to this day, the organization rescues thousands and thousands of cats, dogs, puppies, and kittens, and rehomes more than 2,000 every single year into their permanent families.
Wow, I had no idea that that's how it started and why it started. Fantastic. Okay, yeah. We're going to take a quick break here, Doug.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to Catskill Character with today's guest, Doug Ray. This is Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we have a poignant and soulful look at Caribbean food with Chef Ralston Williams. And we've got the internet's favorite meatball, Dan Pelosi, taking your cooking questions with me. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11.
on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Emma Straub, novelist and children's book author. Her new book, American Fantasy, takes place on a cruise ship with a 1990s boy band. She'll also talk about running one of New York's most beloved independent bookstores. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. New York State's primary election is June 23rd. June 13th is the last day to register to vote in this election. The deadline to change your party enrollment for the primary has passed. Any registered voter may apply for an early mail ballot. The deadline to request a mail-in or absentee ballot in New York is June 13th. More info at elections.ny.gov. This is Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Doug Ray of Narrowsburg, New York. In the first half of the show, Doug spoke about growing up in Dayton, Ohio, and learning the value of hard work, which paid off for him when in junior and senior high school, he became a springboard and platform diving champion. Instead of giving up when he was told that he would never be successful at it because he started too late, Doug was challenged to prove himself. We spoke about that and how being gay contributed to Doug's need to overachieve. After college, Doug made a name for himself in advertising while experiencing several dramatic physical challenges that led to him taking a step back from his tremendously successful career. We're going to hear about that now, so let's get to it. Doug, if only falling off a mountain and recovering was the end of your physical travails, that would be nice. But please tell the listener about your intracranial carotid artery dissection.
Yeah, maybe I'll start by explaining what that is.
Yes.
It sounds very, very serious. And it is, actually. It is a tear in the lining of the carotid artery, which runs from your heart all the way up into your brain. This is not an uncommon thing. Usually it's found in people who are in car accidents, whiplash, anywhere where the neck is moved very quickly can cause that. And usually is a couple centimeters to less than an inch long. Mine ran from just below my neck up into my brain. And it happened while I happened to be on a business trip. I was in London. I was trying to get a workout in, pushing myself too hard, had too little sleep, too stressed out, and tore the lining of my carotid artery. So it was a 6-month recovery after that, but a pretty scary initial period because from the time it happened till it was diagnosed, you're at risk for a major stroke via a blood clot.
What are the symptoms of that?
Massive headaches. And in fact, it's a neurological condition. And so what finally caused my doctor to realize that something was wrong and I needed an MRI was a simple question, which is, you know, do you feel like you're having the worst headaches of your entire life? And I was. I also had some hearing loss, but it was mostly the headaches. In fact, I was having to leave work because I could not concentrate because the headaches were so bad.
Well, that's a tell for you. You're going to leave work.
Absolutely.
And this happened 1 month before your wedding. I was wondering how recovered you were when you and your husband, John Olson, walked down the aisle.
Yeah, so there's not much that you can do. They can go in and put a stent in your neck. I didn't have that happen. So they essentially put you on blood thinners to limit the possibility of a blood clot and a stroke. And you wait it out. So try to reduce the amount of stress, reduce anything that will raise your blood pressure. I had been grounded from work, meaning I couldn't get on a plane. And keep in mind, I was in this global role. So that was stressful, but that's what I needed to do. And I did prioritize my health. And 6 months later, walked away after an ultrasound with a clean bill of health. It had healed perfectly. And there was no concern about it recurring going forward.
This is when the pros and cons of perseverance come into play. Sometimes it takes a long time to learn a lesson. And you didn't really learn your lesson from that horrible experience because you are so driven. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes, I would agree with that.
So 5 years later, 5 years of you continuing to have a hugely successful career, which eventually led to you gaining such industry accolades as Executive of the Year, Media Maven, Media Agency of the Year, Leader and Legend, and Agency Innovator. And in 2021, your transformative work in diversity, equity, and inclusion culminated in a radio show and podcast called More Than That with Gia Peppers, for which you received the National Service Award. At that point, you stepped away from your career, putting it on pause. What happened?
Oh, goodness. It was a big moment. So I had a couple situations. In 2018, I had continued to push and continue to drive forward the organization with the goal of winning new business and growing. At the same time, I was missing out on life. I had nieces and nephews and goddaughter who were growing up, going to college, and I had this moment of, my gosh, where did the last 10 years go? Because I haven't been present. And that was a big reckoning for me in the sense of what is important. And then by the time 2021 and 2022 came along, I started to really understand that the focus that I put so much effort into in terms of my career was starting to define who I was. And I had lost the other elements that made me who I was. And so there were a series of things that kind of happened simultaneously that brought me to the very difficult decision, but ultimately a very good decision to step away from the corporate world, which I had spent over 30 years in, and define what was going to be next for me.
Yeah, that must have been a huge decision for you. Before we move on from that, I just want to go over the panic attacks, because I think there's so many listeners out there who probably are having them and they don't even know they're having them. They're very common. What did you do to mitigate those symptoms and talk about the symptoms that you had?
I would say having a heightened level of stress and anxiety for such a long period of time, I lost 15, almost 20 pounds. Some people, when they get anxious, will overeat. I just stopped eating because I felt nauseous when I would eat. So that was one symptom, was weight loss and fatigue. I was certainly irritable. But the day that I had the panic attack, I literally got dizzy. I had sort of this tunnel vision where the room was closing in on me. And then I couldn't speak. I couldn't formulate a sentence, and then broke down. It felt like there was the weight of the world on me. It almost felt like I was having a heart attack. Thank God I had a very good doctor that said, you're not going back to the office. And I said, but I've got this pitch to work on. I've got this project that I'm doing, and so on. He said, you need to treat this mental health crisis with the same respect as a physical health crisis. And I did. I took 3 months off work, and my company, thank goodness, allowed me to do that. That was a huge wake-up call. And then over that 3 months, I really started to look to things that I could do to manage that anxiety, like meditation. There was a book, to this day, I do not know who sent me this book. It's called 10% Happier. It's by Dan Harris, who was a ABC correspondent, had a panic attack on air, and it talked about his journey. And so I read that and I learned about some of the things that he was doing, journaling every day in the morning, going on walks to just clear my head, spending time with my family, and in particularly spending time with my dog. These were all tools that I now have in my toolkit to help me manage when that anxiety comes on, which it does, you know, every single week. But I now have the mechanism to deal with that, where I didn't have the mechanisms and I just would push through it, you know, just soldier on.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, you know, you got to take a step back. You know, I've learned about chronic stress and cortisol and how it can increase chances of cancer as mm-hmm. well, amongst many other things.
You took the time to examine what was going on for you, and that was a great decision. But Doug, after all that you had done, that must have been so hard for you.
Yeah, it was incredibly hard. As I said, you know, I feel like my entire identity was tied up in, you know, the roles that I had been in and the accolades that I had achieved and the clients that and the relationships that I had formed in work. And, you know, 90% of my conversations, you know, both socially and professionally, were about work. And I realized that going forward, that wasn't what was going to fulfill me. And I needed to redefine what those tenets were, you know, of who I was, and not have it be so lopsided and so focused on work at all costs. It was a big decision, and having the support of my family. I was afraid that I was going to let down people that I work with and let down my family, because I was going to have to take a step back, and there's financial implications of that and so many other things. But there was this sort of groundswell around me with friends and family that made me feel assured that I could do this.
Right. I have one more question, but before I get to that, I want you to talk about imposter syndrome, because that is something that I think a lot of people deal with. And you spoke about it. I'd love for you to share it with the listener.
Absolutely. It's something that I think I probably have had throughout my whole career. And maybe it comes back to my childhood and, you know, maybe feeling a little bit less than, maybe because of where I grew up or being gay or whatnot. But you get into these roles and you step into these positions. And I was very uncomfortable sometimes taking on these new roles and feeling the pressure associated with them, and starting to have a voice in my head that would suggest that I wasn't prepared or I wasn't qualified for the role that I was in. And that added even more stress. You know, when that voice got louder and louder, you need to find a way to recognize that that's happening. But interestingly, I've spoken to so many successful individuals in business and in life, in all sorts of industries, and they talk about that imposter syndrome, and nobody proactively offers that up, yet it's happening all the time. And I think there's some good in that, because if you're not feeling uncomfortable, you're not growing. But if that uncomfortableness starts to become a mental health issue for you, then you've got to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Doug, I know tomorrow is your birthday, so I want to say have a very, very happy, happy birthday. And secondly, I'm wondering what your plans are for this year and going forward.
Well, first off, thank you so much for the early birthday wish. I love birthdays. But going forward, I started a advisory firm called Ray Media Advisory, and I work with publishers, ad tech companies, ad agencies, and brand marketers. And I do a lot of the work that I loved doing when I was working at a big agency, but I do it on my terms. And I work with great clients, and I work with collaborators that are independent consultants that want to come in and work with me on a project. And I just love it. And it's giving me the balance that I didn't have previously. And it's allowing me to, you know, kind of define what success looks like. So who knows where I'll be, you know, 2-3 years from now. I don't try to project that far into the future anymore. And, you know, I'm just hoping that I can make this successful.
I'm glad you're not trying to project that far into the future anymore, that you're taking things slower. And I'm so very glad that you came on today. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you so much, Donna. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
This has been Catskill Character with today's guest, Doug Ray. Doug's website is Ray Media Advisory. That's all one word. .com. Catskill Character is on every Saturday except the last Saturday of the month, when Greg Triggs brings us Travels with Triggs in the 10:30 time slot. Join us then for more stories from fascinating characters of the Catskills and beyond. I'm Donna Fellenberg. This is Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. Thank you so much for listening.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Alzo Slade learned the danger of using AI for medical advice.
Yeah, it told me that I was going through perimenopause.
I'm Tom Papa, filling in for Peter Sagal. I promise you'll feel great when you join us for this week's news quiz on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Seminary Hill, open Friday through Sunday in Calicoon, featuring dinner with a view, live music on Fridays, and weekend brunch. Tours and tastings every Saturday at 11 a.m., and Catskill's Ciderfest returns on Saturday, May 9th. Tickets available on Resy. More information at seminaryhill.co. From generous funding from the Public Media Bridge Fund, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
The satirical newspaper The Onion is taking over InfoWars, the media empire created by right-wing blowhard Alex Jones, and replacing the hate with comedy. Why?
I think people need to hear other people like me remind the world that this is insane. Otherwise, people feel like they're going crazy and that they're alone.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.